Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
Les plateformes de formation en réalité virtuelle, comme ForgeFX, permettent aux élèves en soudure de développer les compétences nécessaires pour débuter et faire évoluer leur carrière. Meta et le métavers ont déjà un impact.
After Oppenheimer's success at the Oscars, why not delve into the history of the atomic bomb and key characters from that period of history with a podcast? The Bomb from the BBC World Service explores the race to beat the Nazis in developing the atomic bomb and the scientists and spies who changed history. Listen to the whole series now by searching for The Bomb wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
Where to Be a Woman is the podcast celebrating the best of women's well-being.
Listen now wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. I'm Nick Miles, and in the early hours of Saturday, the 16th of March, these are our main stories. America's top diplomat has warned a wave of highly potent synthetic drugs, including fentanyl, is spreading across the world. The leaders of Germany, France and Poland have made a show of solidarity for Ukraine after meeting in Berlin for emergency talks. A new party has been launched in Hungary to take on the right-wing Prime Minister Viktor Orban. Also in this podcast.
They grow very quickly, they breed very quickly. They're excellent converters of food. They're particularly good at converting protein.
So what is this animal that could help feed the world sustainably? The US Secretary of State, Antony Blinken, has called for urgent international cooperation to fight the huge rise in trafficking of synthetic drugs like fentanyl. Speaking at the annual UN Commission on Narcotic Drugs, Mr. Blinken said synthetic drugs were now the number one killer of Americans between the ages of 18 and 45. He said that everywhere in the world, the use of these drugs and overdose deaths were rapidly rising. And the only way to stop this was by working together. Our US State Department correspondent Tom Bateman reports.
The global synthetic drug problem is diversifying and proliferating around the world.
The conference hall screens were filled with warning messages. The thousands of delegates here are meant to find the solutions. But nations have failed to tame the growing trade in a wave of new illicit drugs. The presence of Antony Blinken, the first time a US Secretary of State has spoken here, shows how big a problem the issue is for the US, given his foreign agenda is otherwise dominated by the wars in Ukraine and the Middle East. Fallout from the abuse of fentanyl, a synthetic opioid many times more potent than heroin, has laid waste to entire American communities. And Mr. Blinken said the impact was being felt everywhere.
We've seen the scourge of synthetic drugs touch virtually every town, every city, every state in the United States. More than 40% of the American people know someone who died from an opioid overdose. The number one killer of Americans between the ages of 18 and 45 is fentanyl.
The issue weighs on already tense relations between the US and China, where many of the so-called precursor chemicals to make fentanyl come from. They are often trafficked to Mexico to be used in the manufacture of the drug, where cartels often use guns made in America, weapons flooded illegally over the border. Mr. Blinken warned that the opioid problem was likely to move further afield.
We've been something of a canary in the coal mine. It hit us hard. It hit us first. But now we're seeing as markets are saturated, criminal enterprises trying to make markets in other parts of the world. And so what came to us one day, alas, may be coming to you another.
The process for monitoring and controlling precursor chemicals for fentanyl is called scheduling. And the summit is considering adding two further chemicals to these global lists. But UN officials say the process amounts to a losing battle because as soon as one substance is put out of reach of the drug traffickers, another comes along to replace it.
Tom Bateman. A judge overseeing the Georgia election meddling case against the former US President Donald Trump has rejected an attempt by him to secure the disqualification of the lawyer leading the prosecution. The judge ruled that Fani Willis could continue to prosecute Mr. Trump and 18 others But he said Nathan Wade, the special prosecutor Ms. Willis appointed and had a romantic relationship with, would have to go. Mr. Wade handed in his resignation shortly after the ruling. Julian Marshall spoke to Rema Raman, the White House and legal affairs editor for The Hill, a political website in Washington, and asked her first about the resignation of Nathan Wade.
He submitted his resignation and Willis has accepted that resignation.
So the case continues.
That's correct. The judge's ruling today indicated that she may stay on the case so long as Mr. Wade is no longer on it. As I said, that is now the case. So she does get to stay. So technically, this is a win for her, though I do think that her credibility here has been quite damaged. And that was really laid out in the judge's ruling as well. You know, he called into question her judgment. He called her unprofessional in terms of her conduct on the witness stand, which she took in the courtroom a few weeks ago. And he also criticized a speech that she gave at a church shortly after these allegations were unearthed. So while she does get to stay on the case, and thus that means this case does get to move forward, I think her credibility and her judgment has been very much called into question here.
And what was this romantic relationship that she was said to have had with Nathan Wade?
So they had met in 2019 and appeared to remain friends. This is according to both of their accounts on the witness stand. They had remained friends. She brought him on as a top prosecutor to investigate the election subversion case against Donald Trump. And then they maintained that they began dating after that. What the Trump defense attorneys allege is that they were dating before that and thus created a conflict of interest, and also that they took a lot of these lavish trips together using the money that he was being paid by the Fulton County District Attorney's Office in his contract. They were not able to prove that, and there were no firm conclusions drawn in terms of where exactly their relationship began and whether there was an actual conflict. But the judge was able to say today in that ruling that there was enough of an appearance of a conflict of interest. And thus, that was part of his rationale in terms of letting her stay on. But Mr. Wade could no longer continue on the case.
And has there been an indication that Mr. Trump and his co-defendants will appeal the judge's ruling?
So their response so far has been pretty tepid when it comes to Trump lawyers in general. They have the option of appealing, but also in a way, it's actually unclear to me if they are going to pursue any sort of appeals, because I think that in a way, they sort of had a win here, too, in terms of they were able to completely sidetrack this case and create a sort of a sideshow when it comes to, you know, they had the prosecutors charging them being under investigation themselves.
So will a date be set for the trial itself before the November election?
That remains to be seen. This is the one criminal case in which a trial date has never been set. I think part of that has to do with the fact that there are so many other co-defendants as well, and each one of their cases has sort of taken on its own life. So it remains to be seen if a trial date will be set in this case sometime later on this year. So far, the other three cases have had delays. And so, you know, Trump's main goal here is to not have a trial held before the November 2024 election, in which he's running quite closely against President Biden as of now. And that is looking increasingly possible as the days go on here.
Rema Raman, the White House and legal affairs editor for The Hill political website. The leaders of Germany, France and Poland have agreed to step up the purchase and production of weapons for Ukraine to use in its fight against Russia. After meeting in Berlin, Chancellor Olaf Scholz said allies of Ukraine would establish a coalition to supply Kyiv with long-range artillery. The French president, Emmanuel Macron, said Europe had to give support to Ukraine to prevent the conflict from spreading.
It's our future, our security, which is at stake in Ukraine. We are doing this out of solidarity for the people of Ukraine whose territorial integrity is being threatened. We are doing this to defend international law, and we are doing it because the security of Europeans and of us is at stake in Ukraine.
For more on the talks, here's our Berlin correspondent, Jessica Parker.
The trio performed a very vigorous three-way handshake as they unsubtly sought to send a message of unity. Weeks of barbed remarks between Paris and Berlin over their respective levels of support for Ukraine have combined with an increasing divergence in tone. President Emmanuel Macron striking a hawkish note towards Russia, while Chancellor Olaf Scholz has remained characteristically cautious. But Germany's leader insisted today they are all staunch in their backing for Kyiv.
Wir stehen eng.
We stand closely and unwaveringly at Ukraine's side. We made that clear from the start, and that is true for as long as it takes. It's clear that we support Ukraine, and it's also clear that we are not at war with Russia.
Chancellor Scholz said they'd agreed to boost arms production and procure more weapons on the global market. These three countries know that their relationship is key as Europe grapples with how to keep a promise of long-term support for Ukraine while also making the continent more self-reliant, given fears that the transatlantic NATO military alliance could be undermined if Donald Trump were to get back into the White House after US elections later this year.
Jessica Parker in Germany. On the day the leaders of Germany, France and Poland made that show of solidarity for Ukraine, Russian missiles struck a residential area in the Black Sea port of Odessa, killing at least 20 people. More than 70 others are being treated in hospital. Our Eastern Europe correspondent Sarah Rainsford sent this report from Kyiv.
After the first Russian missile hit in Odessa, emergency teams rushed to the scene. But as they worked to put out the fire and to treat casualties, another rocket hit. Video from the aftermath captures the distress of relatives and colleagues of the dead and the injured. They include rescue workers and a medic. There are bodies under blankets and pools of blood on the street. We don't know what the Russians were targeting in this residential area of Odessa, but we do know some of the dead were serving with the Interior Ministry. There are no more details yet. Tonight, President Zelensky said this attack was carried out by scum, and he vowed that Ukraine's military would make sure those he called the Russian killers felt the response.
Sarah Rainsford in Ukraine. As the first day of Russia's presidential election drew to a close, the head of the UN condemned the holding of polls in parts of Ukraine occupied by Russian forces. Antonio Guterres stressed that the illegal annexation of Ukrainian regions, including Donetsk and Zaporizhia, had no validity under international law. Several people have been detained for what Russian officials termed vandalism at polling stations. Ballot boxes were set alight or coated in dye. The election, which is taking place over 3 days, will almost certainly return Vladimir Putin as Russian president for a fifth time. Polling is also taking part in Moldova and Georgia. Our Russia editor, Steve Rosenberg, sent this report from Moscow.
Russian democracy is the best in the world, the Kremlin says. And they clearly want everyone to hear that. At a polling station in Siberia, voters were greeted by a folk ensemble. Well, the authorities like banging the drum for their elections. But best democracy is not an accurate label. The Kremlin tightly controls Russia's political system, and that includes elections, which are designed and conducted to ensure that Vladimir Putin wins. Nothing new there. But this was new. Get the fire extinguisher, she cries, after a fire erupts inside a different polling station. It was one of a string of unprecedented attacks on polling stations across Russia, which included someone pouring green ink into a ballot box. The authorities called the attackers scum. When the official result is announced, it's expected to be a Putin landslide. Allah will be happy. Of course, I've just voted for Putin, Allah tells me. I trust him. He never makes a mistake. That is a lot of trust to put in one man who's been ruling Russia for nearly a quarter of a century with few checks and balances.
Steve Rosenberg in Russia. Scientists are carrying out an experiment to try to stop the Arctic's sea ice from melting because of climate change. They've been testing technology just off the mainland of Canada, which thickens ice sheets with layers of seawater. Our science correspondent, Paleb Ghosh, has been speaking to those involved in the project. Researchers pump seawater on top of the Arctic ice so that it freezes and thickens. It's such a simple idea that it's surprising that no one's tried it before. Speaking to us from the test site in the Arctic Circle is Andrea Ceccolini, head of the company Realice, which is installing the pumps.
We are pumping around 1,000 litres per minute of seawater. Today we'll add an extra layer, so we'll add probably another 5 to 10 centimetres of ice thickness in this area.
The amount of sea ice has fallen dramatically, from an average of 7 million square kilometres during the summer minimum in the 1980s to around 4.5 million square kilometres in the past decade. Polar bears and other Arctic creatures will lose their homes, and the rest of the world will be much worse off, because the sea ice is an air conditioning system for the entire planet, reflecting the sun's rays back into space. Researchers at Cambridge University's Centre for Climate Repair are assessing whether the ice thickening project will actually work, and if so, how it could best be implemented.
If we just allow the sea ice to go, the Arctic Ocean becomes one of our greatest heat absorbers rather than one of our greatest heat reflectors. We let it go, things are going to get even worse. We've got to try and fix that.
The researchers expect to know by next year whether their ice thickening scheme has the potential to fix the Arctic, and by a little more time to reduce greenhouse gas emissions to prevent dangerous and irreversible damage to our planet.
Palab Ghosh. Still to come.
HMS Tiger was patrolling the waters of what's now Dry Tortugas National Park when it ran aground during the Anglo-Spanish War.
The wreck of the long-lost British warship has now been identified off the coast of Florida, nearly 300 years after it sank.
It all started with me asking my friends and family to write letters to my daughter, Coco, sharing their experiences and giving her advice for her life ahead. The idea blossomed into Dear Daughter from the BBC World Service, the podcast where, with the help of your letters, I'm creating a handbook to life full of advice for daughters everywhere. Listen now by searching for Dear Daughter wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
Dear Daughter.
Welcome back to the Global News Podcast. Israel's Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu says he's approved plans for an offensive against Hamas in Gaza's Rafah city. He added that the Israeli military is preparing for the evacuation of the nearly 1.5 million civilians sheltering there. The announcement comes despite President Biden's warning that such an assault, which aid agencies say could prove disastrous for civilians, would breach a red line. The White House National Security Council spokesperson John Kirby said Washington would only support an Israeli offensive if it was given an evacuation plan.
We can't support a major offensive in Rafah that doesn't also include a credible, achievable, executable plan to take care and for the safety and security of the more than 1 million Gazans that are seeking refuge in Rafah. To move in right now in a major way without a proper accounting for all those people would, as we've said, be a disaster.
It emerged earlier in the day that an Israeli team is travelling to Qatar for new talks on a possible ceasefire and hostage deal. But Israel's Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu has downplayed the chances of a truce in Gaza. That after Hamas gave what it called a comprehensive vision to mediators. Hamas is regarded as a terrorist group by many Western governments. The last ceasefire was in November. And for those in Gaza, the situation is getting more and more desperate. Hospitals in the worst affected areas in the north have reported children dying of starvation. Well, getting aid into the territory has been a real issue, but Friday brought hope that a new route by sea could work. A ship carrying food supplies arrived. Gerard Canals is Operations Director for Open Arms. That's one of the charities behind the relief operation.
This is the first operation, and obviously the amount of food that we brought here it isn't enough. It's just a tiny part of the daily needs. But we have to think of it on as a test, and we are doing it. So I think we can bring a lot of food if this operation ends well. And again, this is just a test, and probably we can continue and scale it up.
Our correspondent in Jerusalem, Mark Lowen, told us about the logistical problems of distributing the aid.
They're huge, particularly in an area where civil order has broken down. And you'll remember, Nick, last month when there was that chaotic aid distribution in which 112 people were killed. The Palestinians said they were shot by Israelis, by the Israeli forces. Israel says that was not the case, and that they were there was a stampede, and that they were run over by some of the aid trucks. But it all shows how, when you are desperate, when you are starving, and when you desperately need aid, getting it out and distributing it is very, very tricky. And I'm sure they will face similar kinds of issues with the aid that has come in from the ship. A couple of the crates have already been offloaded onto smaller boats, which are then transporting it into Gaza, basically. I mean, vehicles will have to drive it in eventually, I suppose. It's not exactly clear. There was also another fatal incident on Wednesday when the Palestinians said that 21 people were killed at an aid distribution point in Gaza City, again blaming the Israeli forces for opening fire. Israel says it's looked into the incident and it was not to blame. It's blamed Palestinian armed gunmen. So all of that, again, showing just how chaotic and fatal this can be.
Meanwhile, Mark, Benjamin Netanyahu has sent a negotiating team to Qatar looking into new talks on a possible ceasefire, but he's playing down the chances of a truce in Gaza, isn't he?
He is. He said that Hamas's renewed proposals are unrealistic. Largely, I think that Hamas demand that there be a full ceasefire in Gaza and a withdrawal of Israeli forces, because Israel says that it will not withdraw its forces while Hamas is still in power there or in place, and that it needs to have overall security control in some way over Gaza. Now, there's always kind of the mixed messaging here, and, you know, pronouncements made in order to increase pressure on other sides. So whilst on the one hand sending an Israeli delegation to Doha to continue talking, Benjamin Netanyahu has also apparently green-lighted a military operation by the Israeli forces into Rafah in southern Gaza, where half of Gaza's population is sheltering, which would of course go against any ceasefire. And I think that pronouncement is clearly made to increase the pressure on Hamas ahead of any future ceasefire talks. I mean, I think that the fact that both sides are talking is clearly a sign of some progress, but I don't think anybody is expecting an imminent breakthrough.
What about pressure on Mr. Netanyahu, though? President Biden has praised a speech made by the US Senate leader Chuck Schumer yesterday, in which he called for elections to be held in Israel, and he also said that Mr. Netanyahu was a threat to peace. Is that constructive pressure, do you think?
It's very hard to know whether it's constructive. I mean, I think that it clearly shows the depth of exasperation that there is from the Biden administration towards Israel and towards Benjamin Netanyahu in particular. It was met with a very angry response, I have to say, by Likud, the governing party here, that said Israel is not a banana republic. It proudly elected Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu. But I think Biden, by throwing his weight behind Schumer, who is the top Jewish official, actually, in the US administration, shows just how acrimonious the relationship is between Washington and the Israelis at the moment. And that would only increase if Israel does push into Rafah without any kind of credible evacuation plan for the 1.4 million people who are sheltering there.
Mark Lowen. Sudan's civil war between two rival factions of the military government has lasted for nearly a year now. As of the start of 2024, the conflict had reportedly killed at least 13,000 people, injuring 33,000, and made more than 7 million civilians homeless. But there is a glimmer of hope. The US Special Envoy to Sudan, Tom Perriello, says there's a fresh political will in the region for ending the fighting. He spoke to our correspondent, Barbara Plett-Usher, in Nairobi.
He'd been speaking to a lot of Sudanese civilians so far in his trip, and he talked about their plans and hopes for a transition to democracy after the war was over. But he spoke a lot more about the humanitarian crisis, which needed to be urgently addressed in the next weeks, in particular that both warring sides must give aid access. And that is a real focus of his trip because it's catastrophic conditions there at the moment. But he also spoke about the danger that Sudan could become a center of regional instability, that it could see the return of militant Islamist extremists, that this was helping to focus minds in the region.
If we start to look at a failed state and a factionalized conflict, we're seeing the return of militant extreme Islamists in the area. I think it's been publicly reported about the rise of extreme Islamists within SAF ranks. It's deeply concerning. I think we see a war that has no sign of either side having a clean victory. So anyone who might have thought that was an outcome to root for, I think that day has come and gone.
So, Barbara, he ended up there by saying, look, there's a possible route to end this. But how achievable is that in the short term, do you think?
You know, it doesn't look achievable to the naked eye, that's for sure. There's a dynamic and rhetoric of war. There was supposed to be a ceasefire over Ramadan. The UN called for one. That's definitely not happening. Any attempt at talks to have even just a short humanitarian truce has failed. But what the envoy said was that he saw an increase in political will amongst the regional players.
These generals can solve this tomorrow. This region can solve it. And I think there's an enormous amount of political will right now to do that, more than I've seen in the past few months. I think many of those leaders, if we could go back in a time machine, would have understood what cost this was going to have. I think there is tremendous interest in ending this.
So I think that the administration is quite aware that the Sudanese feel that they have been forgotten nearly 1 year after the war, with the situation just looking as if it's heading into an even worse catastrophe than it's been in so far. And again, the administration is trying to signal greater priority here with the appointment of the envoy. But there's been a lot of pressure from Congress demanding that an envoy be appointed. And so he certainly has his work cut out for him, but he did radiate energy and enthusiasm and urgency.
Barbara Pledasha. For the past 14 years, Prime Minister Viktor Orban and his Fidesz party have held onto power in Hungary with an iron grip. He's repeatedly clashed with European Union colleagues on migration and the war in Ukraine, and he's seen as Vladimir Putin's closest ally within the European Union. But now there is a man on the scene attempting to challenge that. Peter Magyar, himself once a high-ranking member of Fidesz, has formed a new party, and tens of thousands of people turned up at a rally he held on Friday in Budapest. Our correspondent Nick Thorpe was there.
Obviously, it's very early days. Peter Magyar, a 43-year-old former member of the Fidesz, the governing party elite, has come out in the last month with some searing criticism of the governing party. You know, this is a governing party under Viktor Orban, which has really had unchallenged power in Hungary for the past 14 years. The existing six or so opposition parties have been very weak indeed. Peter Magyar, in a way, coming from an unexpected position, a businessman, a former diplomat, very much an insider in Fidesz, has been launching these searing attacks on what he calls the corruption, the nepotism, the propaganda machinery of the governing party. And after initially just criticising them, he's now taken the decision just in the last days to set up a new party, a new centrist party, which he's calling, curiously, in a way, Stand Up Hungarians. So it's a very new phenomenon, and it's much too early, I suppose, to speculate how successful it might be. But certainly today, on Hungary's National Day, tens of thousands of people came out to hear what he had to say.
And yet, obviously, Mr. Orban doesn't think it's the right time for anybody to challenge him. Earlier on, he was telling cheering supporters that his views, being sceptical about the war in Ukraine, were going to be the majority by the end of the year globally.
That's right, yes. Mr. Orban's speech this morning to an admittedly smaller crowd, and Mr. Orban's used to having much bigger crowds than anyone else here in Hungary, but very much the emphasis of Mr. Orban's speech this morning, fresh from his trip to the United States where he met Donald Trump, where he strongly endorsed Donald Trump, and basically Mr. Orban told his supporters this morning that with the upcoming European parliamentary elections on the 9th of June, followed by, of course, the US elections in November, he's confident that his brand of national conservatism, of populism, will, as he put it, become a majority in the world by the end of this year.
Bullish about his support, then. Is he right?
It's difficult to tell, really. Obviously, one doesn't know how the European parliamentary elections will pan out, or indeed in advance of the US elections. He's not used to having a challenger at home, so he's had a very strong position because of his strong democratic legitimacy at home, winning election after election. What's new in terms of Peter Magyar popping up, he's the first real charismatic leader that any opposition grouping have managed to produce in the 30-odd years that I've been covering Hungarian politics.
Nick Thorpe. The first black woman to edit British Vogue has dismissed suggestions that the magazine is out of touch, saying there's a fantasy element to fashion. Choema Nardi has just taken over the prestigious publication from the first black man to run the magazine, Edward Enifil. She started her career in newspapers in the UK before moving to New York and joining Vogue there. Launching her first edition in charge, Choema Nardi told the BBC why it was so important for people like her to take the helm.
Not something in my wildest dreams that I would have imagined for myself, probably because I didn't see anyone similar in my position when I was a kid. And I know how meaningful it is for younger people to see someone like me who looks like me in a position like this, you know. And I think that's probably one of the most rewarding parts about having this job, is knowing that I can inspire someone and I can make someone think, yeah, you know, that could be me one day. And that's really meaningful.
Choema Nardi. The wreck of a long-lost British warship has been identified off the coast of Florida, nearly 300 years after it sank. Electra Naismith reports.
HMS Tiger was patrolling the waters of what's now Dry Tortugas National Park when it ran aground during the Anglo-Spanish War. What happened next is a swashbuckling tale that's scarcely believable. The 300-strong crew spent 2 months marooned on a deserted island known today as Garden Key. They battled heat, thirst and mosquitoes, all while making repeated attempts to get help and avoid Spanish naval vessels. Eventually, they made a dramatic escape, using makeshift boats to sail more than 1,000 kilometres through enemy waters to Port Royal in Jamaica.
Electra Naismith. Now, we've heard that eating less beef, chicken or pork can help reduce CO2 emissions and take the strain off global food production. But is there another option we haven't considered? How about eating python? Well, a new study says it could be a new and sustainable solution. Alfie Habershon, tell me more.
Well, this won't sound like the most appealing meal choice to many listeners, but this study, produced by a group of scientists around the world called People for Wildlife, says python is in fact quite tasty. Co-author Patrick Orr says it's just like chicken, admittedly something we've heard before when presented with things like crocodiles or frog's legs. He also says there's no shortage of ways to put python on your plate. The scientists tried it barbecued, on satay skewers and in curries whilst eating it alongside indigenous communities in the Malaysian jungle. It was even dried to make python biltong. But the key point here is how sustainable it is when compared to other protein on the market, as Mr. Orst explains.
They grow very quickly, they breed very quickly, they're excellent converters of food, they're particularly good at converting protein. They don't mind living in high densities. With species like pythons, we know they live on a three-dimensional plane. They live underground, they live on the ground, and they also live in trees. So you can farm them on the vertical plane.
So, Alfie, there seem to be some really compelling reasons there, economic reasons and environmental reasons to do this. Snakes are pretty tasty. I've tasted it a couple of occasions on holiday, but it's going to be a pretty tough sell, isn't it, to get people around the world to put it in their daily shopping basket.
That's right, Dick. No matter how many recipes you're prepared to come up with, it's going to be a hard sell. The study does point to many parts of Asia and Africa where eating python is much less of a taboo, and says that's where the commercial farming could really take off. On top of that, it may also become more appealing as a result of climate change. We've already seen farmers around the world struggling to keep their cows, goats and pigs alive last year due to record-breaking heat waves, whereas pythons are pretty tough. In fact, the study points out they can go almost a year without even eating. But it's worth noting that the whole scientific community is not won over on this. Pythons need to change their body temperatures voluntarily and will need hotter and cooler areas to grow in, something critics say would be complicated and expensive to provide on an industrial scale. They also suggest that we should end our obsession with eating animals and just accept that the best way to feed the world is with a plant-based diet. But admittedly, python satay skewers do sound a bit more exciting.
Alfie Habershon. And that's all from us for now, but there will be a new edition of the Global News podcast later on. If you want to comment on this podcast or the topics covered in it, you can send us an email. The address is globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. You can also find us on X at Global News Pod. This edition was mixed by Pat Sissons. The producer was Leah McSheffrey. The editor is Karen Martin. I'm Nick Miles, and until next time, goodbye.